What's the quote unquote good part of a recession? If inflation comes down to 2%, the Fed would have the ability and probably the need to cut rates to offset that recessionary action on the government spending side. That's also, I think, what the administration wants is lower interest rates. And you've seen that in 10-year rates, which would allow us to refinance our debt, which is very short-term oriented, towards more spread out over time. So the way I look at the future is no one knows, but you should use history to kind of come up with as many possible scenarios as you can.
And the explanation cannot be found in any mathematics, but it has to be found in investor psychology.
You know, the game in our kind of life is being able to recognize a good idea when you rarely get it. What is the old saying? That opportunity comes to the prepared mind.
Human nature hasn't changed a lot in 25,000 years. I think volatility is terrific.
Lose money for the firm and I will be understanding. Lose a shred of reputation for the firm and I will be ruthless.
All right, listeners, before we jump into this interview with Jan Van Eck, I want to remind everyone that AUM is a FinChat original podcast. FinChat is the complete financial data platform for global equities. And with the release of this interview, I thought it'd be good to mention that Van Eck is not only a big customer of FinChat, but they actually love the platform so much that they're also investors in our company. If you're looking to improve your own firm's research process, head on over to finchat.io. Welcome to AUM. On this show, we dive into the process, strategy, methods, and lessons from some of the world's best asset managers. We explore what it takes to produce outstanding investment outcomes in the complex adaptive system that is modern markets. I'm your host, Ryan Henderson, and today I have the absolute pleasure of being joined by Jan Van Eck. Jan is the CEO of Van Eck and has been with the firm since 1991. In his time at Van Eck, Jan has witnessed and been the pioneer of some major changes in the asset management and ETF industry. Jan was also the recipient of ETF.com's 2024 Lifetime Achievement Award. Jan, it's a pleasure to have you on. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ryan. Good to be here.
So I want to dive in to Van Eck's process overall, but before we do that, I want to get some background, I guess, on your career. Van Eck is based in New York. I believe you've spent most of your time in New York, but reading through some of your personal history, it sounds like you spent some time in Silicon Valley as well. I'm curious if that time created any lessons for you, anything that stuck with you overall that maybe has made you become a better investor.
Yeah, super formative. When I graduated from college, it wasn't 100% clear what I wanted to do. So I went to the trial and error method. Worked at a think tank in Washington, D.C., and then, headed out to Silicon Valley, basically just volunteered for a job and then ended up getting hired. But I met some founders and VCs and was very inspired, I would say, or attracted to the risk-taking, but really, it's obviously high risk, but really the creativity that's involved with coming up with new products in new industries, very similar to FinChat. And, the flip side of that is to, which Andy Grove used to say, manage through paranoia, because you can always be disrupted. So I think it was very formative in how I think about business, but it made business extremely attractive to me.
One other thing I saw that seemed a bit abnormal, at least for a lot of the investment managers I've spoken to, is you studied law. I guess what motivated you to go back to school for that? And then has that helped, if at all, in running Van Eck?
Well, I went back. I was lucky enough to get into Stanford, so it helped. So I was able to spend more time in Silicon Valley, and I took a lot of courses at the business school and networked a lot more with business school people than I did law school people. So I got a lot of business school learning, even though I didn't do a JD MBA. What I think law, I was an econ major, so I knew a lot. I think about sort of finance and markets because I'd studied that, but law was a relative area of ignorance. And so I felt like if I was going to, broaden my knowledge, focus on that area that needed strengthening. And indeed, I learned a lot. But really what law does in a civil society is tell you kind of how the world works. And especially in finance, which is heavily regulated, I think it's a perspective. I make it the analogy to like medicine, where you don't have to be an expert in every single discipline of medicine, but it helps to know what specialties are out there, you know, and who to access when. And so, I found that time period to be very valuable. And I also did internships. I did more of the trial and error. So I worked for a corporate law firm. I worked for a prosecutor one summer, and then a federal prosecutor. And then I also worked for a shareholder rights group one semester in Washington, D.C.
Wow. It sounds like you hopped all over. And I like the analogy there with the medical analogy. You came back to VanEck, I believe, in 1991. And have been there ever since. I'm curious, because a lot has obviously changed in the asset management industry over that time. How has your personal investment approach changed over your career, if at all? And what skills or traits have you picked up over the years?
Yeah, so today, in fact, over the last 24 hours, I was updating our investment outlook. We, as a firm, and I personally deliver a quarterly investment outlook, you know, by video. About 30 to 40,000 people kind of download that now. Our approach is a macro investing. And what I mean by that is that, yes, there are a lot of statistical relationships within the financial markets, if you just look at them. But like, what we like to do is take a step back and say, what are the big picture macro? So what do I mean by macro trends? Technology. A lot of industries are driven by technology, even natural resources, right? You think about fracking. It didn't exist really 20 years ago. So technology, number one, and then political trends. That really matters internationally. Is a country pro-business or not? Economic trends, obviously. What are government policies, fiscal policies, and monetary policies? So I think over the last couple of years, especially during COVID, I started studying more history. And I think where that kind of macro insight can help is from 2 years out to 10 years out. So sorry, let me go on my little diatribe here. So when someone says, okay, name a financial asset. What's gold doing, you know, today, this week, this month? And many people focus on this year, like what's happening this year? And, you know, my point is that you actually probably have less certainty the closer you get to the present. But sometimes if you look further out, you can have a high degree of conviction about a trend, and then that can inform your portfolio. So one of my favorite factoids these days is that the size of the Indian economy is supposed to be as big as continental Europe in the next 10 years. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, okay, their economy is going to grow. Their companies should become more profitable. Does the government facilitate economic growth? Yes. Okay, so that's pretty good. And then, does it have a history of investors being able to make money in stocks? Well, yeah, actually, investing in Indian stocks has been as profitable as investing in U.S. stocks over the last 10 years, which is surprising some people. Okay, so that's a pretty good setup. Are there any obvious risks to that? Well, of course, there could be government changes and things like that, but otherwise, no. And so, you know, if I'm looking at the world going, wow, in 10 years, India is going to be as big as Europe. Okay, that's got some positive growth implications, right, for the world. But it also means India will be a bigger consumer of whatever they're a consumer for now. So in one of the things that we look at is natural resources and gold investing. Well, they're big buyers of gold. Is that likely to continue? Yes, even if prices go up. So that's one takeaway. Another aspect of the gold is that the Indian policymakers do not want to have a dollarized economy. They have foreign exchange controls now as it is. So their they're looking, as a lot of international investors are, to gold as sort of their second currency of choice behind the dollar in terms of foreign reserves and things like that. So you've got, besides the obvious, you know, invest in India, you've got other consequences like probably good demand for gold over the next 10 years, and you can factor that in. And the last kind of India theme, getting very specific, is you always want to invest in those companies that stand between a consumer and the internet, right? So if you think about the Mag 7 in the U.S., they're basically the social, you know, interface. They're the movie interface. They're the, you know, shopping mall interface. So what are those companies in India, or do you have similar opportunities? Well, there are two mobile phone companies that basically control the market. And now over 800 million Indian consumers have cheap cell phone coverage. They used to have 25 cell phone coverage, 25 companies. They beat their brains out. Now there's only two left, which is great for pricing. And so, like, why wouldn't you want to own those two companies over the next 10 years? Right? I mean, okay, one quarter or two, they may be overvalued. The stocks can go down 20%, or earnings will slow because of this. But they're doing all the right things. They're building out a software suite. They're doing cloud computing, AI hosting. They're doing the playbook that you or I would do. So anyway, that's a long story just to say that the VanEck macro philosophy is in that longer term perspective that informs your portfolio today.
Sweet. Yeah, no, that's all really good. And I want to get into more of those specific themes and trends in a sec. But before, I do want to talk about VanEck's research process overall, and maybe more so kind of how you spend your time. As the CEO of a large financial services firm, I'm curious, how do you split your time between investment analysis and managing the other aspects of the business?
Some is externally facing and some is internally facing. I like to spend my mornings ideally more externally facing, whether that's market orientation or client communication. So I like to interface with our clients as much as I can because they ask great questions. And it also makes you sharpen, you know, your thinking when you're actually getting pushback, or at least having a dialogue with clients. It doesn't have to be pushback. So that's basically the mix. You know, I think the number one thing that I've delivered to our clients on is forming funds that have an intelligent way of accessing particular markets. So sometimes you have to take liquidity requirements into account. Sometimes there's a special weighting methodology that might make sense. But, you know, from high yield, I'm happy to give examples, but from high yield to U.S. equities, to even semiconductors, the way we fashioned, or nuclear energy is a recent popular theme, the way we fashioned those ETFs has a really big impact on the overall return and risk outcome of those funds.
What does the process look like for launching a new ETF? How do you guys go from, okay, here's this theme, this trend that we're very optimistic about, to, okay, let's... now here's an actual investment vehicle that our clients can access? What's kind of the in-between there?
Yeah, I mean, look, first of all, you don't want to just chase a fad, number one. And number two, there are some fund concepts where I think the outcome for investors is going to be very different than maybe what's on the label. So that's kind of a negative thing. Like, we want to stay away from that. And then on the positive side, we want to only come to market if we can offer a product with a differentiated return stream. So I'm always looking at what's the risk return. So, with nuclear, just to pick one example, we decided to take a more diversified approach. So not just uranium miners, but also some utilities that are heavily nuclear and they use nuclear energy. And then also some of the what's called industrials, but included some of the newer technologies for the small modular reactors. So by blending those, it was less exciting in some years, but over a multiple year time period, better returns with less risk. That's kind of the the win-win, if you can do that, that's hard. But in that particular example, we were able to provide that.
Perfect. All right. Let's dig into some of these specific trends. One of the ones you mentioned was India. Are there any other emerging economies that you're keeping a close eye on or you, VanEck, is optimistic about?
Well, Vietnam is also kind of a very good macro story, and their stock market has developed such that international investors can get every year a broader sampling into their economy, if you will. So Vietnam is a nominally communist country. I call it China before Xi Jinping. And the growth there is very solid. They're, you know, add a lot of manufacturing, even for high tech, like semiconductors. So that's a great macro story as well. Other countries, you know, you tend, those political trends can be less certain. Like think about in Argentina, where you've had a hard swing towards a pro-government, a pro-business government, but you know, that how sustainable is that? China is making some very positive pro-business noises these days. Whether that's as sustainable as India and Vietnam, I doubt it. So I will point out, this is sort of an idea that we're working on, which is international equity indices really need to be re-examined. And I don't have an answer to this question. I should be able to answer the question and sell you on a new fund idea. But, you know, China came into these emerging market indices at the top of their market. So they were like not included. Then they were included like the 33% at the top of the market. So I think, you know, S&P makes sense domestically because it strips out all the currency and market sizing issues, right? It's much harder for international indices. So, you know, I guess getting back to your question, like Vietnam and India, as stories, have lesser 10-year conviction in a lot of other countries.
Looking at VanEck's history, it seems like you guys have a very, to use sort of a sports analogy here, you guys have a unique ability to kind of skate where the puck is going in terms of some of these trends and themes. One of those being Bitcoin. You and the company overall were very early to Bitcoin. I believe VanEck was the first established ETF issuer to file for a Bitcoin-linked ETF. I guess, give us some history there. When did you first come across Bitcoin, and why do you like it as an asset?
Well, so my father founded the company in 1955, and I want to give him a lot of intellectual credit for being open-minded and risk-taking. And it comes with a historical perspective that the world can change really quickly. So he started the firm to invest overseas in Europe and Japan after World War II. Again, big, obvious multi-decade trend. But he was only, you know, he and Templeton started the same year. So that was pretty early. You know, Americans weren't that interested in international investing back then. So nothing much happened to the company's growth. But then in 1968, he launched what became the first gold fund in the U.S. And to tell you how crazy that was, gold was fixed at $35 an ounce. So like, I bet you've never met a portfolio manager who said, here, buy my portfolio, what it invests in doesn't change in price, right? And not only that, it hadn't changed in price for the entirety of US history. So for the entirety of US history, the dollar had been linked to the price of gold. There was a reset under FDR, but anyway. And he said, listen, that's going to change because of inflation and government spending. And sure enough, 3 years later, it did. So again, investors who had listened to the VanEck macro view and decide for themselves, right? We don't really run macro funds, but we say, here's exposure that you may want to add. So you can fast forward to Bitcoin in 2017. Again, you know, following technology, you know, well aware of Bitcoin. And I said, well, listen, is this going to, you know, disrupt demand for our gold funds? God forbid, that's a cash cow of the firm. that we get disrupted. And if we do it, let's participate. And so did the deep dive, listened to the podcast, read white papers, and you know, kind of thought it through for ourselves, and said, listen, yeah, I mean, this is going to be a part of the store of value solutions for investors. And, you know, it wasn't new to the market that there'd be things like that, right? Because besides gold, there's always been other precious metals like silver, platinum, palladium that people would invest in. So to add Bitcoin to that mix just seems commonsensical, actually. And I've always said since then that, you know, probably Bitcoin demand should be sort of half of that of gold as a proxy, which would sort of be around $400,000 a coin right now. So only, you know, a lot less upside than there used to be. But I don't know. Just, again, openness to change in the world, right? And especially if there's the emergence of a new asset class, like, that's awesome, right? Because it's not going to happen in 1 month or 1 year, but it's a longer term trend. And I think that, again, it's that macro perspective.
Was there some convincing needed from your team to get people on to, seeing this as kind of a formidable asset class and an investable vehicle, or was it pretty well adopted right from the jump?
You know, it's a great question, because there's like a good part and a bad part. The good part is because I'm CEO, you know, we were able, for example, to pivot into ETFs without any cultural feedback because the CEO was leading the charge. He didn't need to, you know, convince higher ups, right? I would say on the negative side, obviously the firm got behind the concept of offering a Bitcoin fund to its clients, but other portfolio managers were reticent to add it to their funds. Like, if we had added 1% of Bitcoin to our gold fund or our natural resources fund, right, that would have been fantastic. It's very hard to persuade people about different kind of crazy possibilities. And obviously there's a lot more things involved, like, you know, investor expectations. If you invest in a gold fund, are you likely to want Bitcoin exposure? A lot of them didn't. And so there's client feedback and all that other kind of stuff. But anyway, I would say success on one hand, but to be fair, Ryan, failure on another.
Okay.
Failure to persuade. And we're still trying to persuade people in the market. I mean, I can tell you the vast majority of people in finance are just not accepting.
Interesting. Would you say that some of the draw to the Bitcoin-linked product was from totally new clients, or was there the appeal from the existing ones as well?
I think early days, what I did notice is that people who had been historical clients who invested in gold mining companies were starting to buy Bitcoin instead. And so they were tolerant of the high volatility of that type of asset class, but obviously kindred spirits in terms of conceiving of the store of value appeal. So it actually started with that kind of interest. And now it's the buyers of the U.S. listed ETFs over the last year have actually tended to be the younger demographic, first-time ETF buyers, even for some of our competitors. Not even, you know, so totally new to the market.
Is there an ETF over your time at VanEck that you are the most excited about launching?
Well, obviously the first one. Just to get into the market finally, because in those days there was no ETF rule, so you literally needed SEC approval to go to market. So that took us years to get our first approval. I don't know why, but legal paperwork stuff. I've got a lot of children, Ryan, but. I mean, I guess I would say that we have a U.S. equity large cap fund that's based on Morningstar Equity Research. So Morningstar is a well-known company for rating mutual funds, but they also have the largest independent stock equity team. And so they package that research into quality companies that have a competitive advantage, but they also use this forward-looking discounting mechanism to buy only the cheaper moat type of companies. And so kind of knew that research was really, really good. So I was excited to kind of bring that to market. And that's been a really good long-term relationship. And I love the fact that, like, over some years, it's outperformed the S&P, even though it's had way less tech exposure. And so that kind of differentiated approach, you know, is super appealing to me. But I could talk for about 3 hours to really answer that question.
Hey, listeners, before we move on, I want to mention the company that actually runs the show. AUM is a FinChat podcast. FinChat.io is the fastest growing equity research platform on the internet. Powered by AI, FinChat offers institutional grade financial data on all stocks globally. And the best part is the data extends well beyond the generic financial metrics. You know all those company specific metrics that you track on your own spreadsheets? I'm talking about Amazon segment revenue, Netflix's paying subscribers by region, Chipotle's comp sales, Uber's active customers, Spotify MAUs. FinChat tracks all of it so you don't have to. If those numbers matter to you, I recommend checking out the platform. All new users get 2 weeks free of FinChat Pro automatically. So head on over to finchat.io and check it out. Now let's get back to the interview. Yeah, hard to pick just one. To shift gears a bit, in an article you wrote in December, you stated that the U.S. faces a, quote, fiscal reckoning. And this is actually, it's funny how this has maybe even become, I guess, more prescient today. Can you elaborate a bit on that? And then what are the potential implications of declining government spending?
So the fiscal reckoning, basically, I pointed out, is U.S. government, federal government spending or overspending, their deficit, deficit measured as a percent of GDP. So obviously, in absolute dollars, our deficit's huge, but even as a percent of GDP, it's huge. And people have pointed out that we're spending more on repaying our debt than we are on anything else. So what I loved about that from a VanEck macro perspective is, you know, it's not only a great 10-year chart, Ryan, that's a great 250-year chart, right? We've never done this so much with a low unemployment rate. I mean, people are going to look back going, what were we thinking spending this much money? And I figured that the U.S. government has a history of dealing with big fiscal or policy issues the year after a presidential election. Most of the time, we're just trying to muddle through and kick the can. But that made me think that this was going to be a year of addressing that or getting more out of control. So that was the government that was the problem, the macro federal budget spending. And so where are we today? I think that there is a realistic scenario whereby DOGE achieves $500 billion to $1 trillion of annual budget reductions, spending reductions. Something like 1.2 to 1.3 trillion of cuts would bring government spending back to its normal percent of GDP at about 21%. Obviously, if we cut that much, we would go from like 6.5% deficit to, I believe, 3% or so. So a massive cut. No, to like 2% of GDP. So a big, big shift. So I think that's a non-discountable possibility. So the analogy I use is sort of we've had 2 feet on the gas pedal. If DOGE takes both feet off the gas pedal, the best word for that is austerity. And if we have austerity and such a slowdown, which could be like a million federal workers or contractors losing their job, that will lead to a recession or something that approximates recessionary conditions. Now, what's the quote-unquote good part of a recession? Inflation comes down. If inflation comes down to 2%, the Fed would have the ability to, and probably the need to, cut rates to offset that recessionary action on the government spending side. And that's also, I think, what the administration wants is lower interest rates. And you've seen that in 10-year rates, which would allow us to refinance our debt, which is very short-term oriented, towards more spread out over time. So the way I look at the future is no one knows, but you should use history to kind of come up with as many possible scenarios as you can. And I really feel like, Ryan, I was talking about this before you and I started speaking. There are people around in my office and on Wall Street that think of this like people were talking about Bitcoin in 2017. Like I was the crazy person, basically. And I'm like, look, they're saying they're doing it, right? I mean, it's not like I'm speculating. The president of the United States said he wants to cut Pentagon spending by 8% a year, right? I mean, the House passed a bill that has about $200 billion in Medicaid spending cuts, which is just undoing what Biden did, but still, it would be a cut relative to last year's budget. They're laying people off. I mean, they're closing offices left and right. So, what estimates people come up with is, but I think they're not weighing that scenario enough. So that's the reckoning. The reckoning is what are we going to do with this big federal budget spending? And, whereas in December, the markets were starting to price in, oh my God, like, they're never going to take the feet off the gas pedal. Inflation stays higher. Interest rates stay higher. Now the market, the 10-year at least, is, in my mind, definitely pricing in, whoa, we're taking not just 1 foot, but 2 feet off the gas pedal. That's austerity. But you heard it here first. What's happening on July 4th, 2026?
Not 4th of July. I'm not sure. What
4th
else?
Of July. So what, how many years will the United States have been around?
Oh, that would make it 250, right?
Okay. Big date, right?
Yeah.
What's happening to Elon Musk on that day?
That I'm not sure.
He's leaving the government.
Oh,
so
wow.
Doge winds down on July 4th, 2026. If you listen to the Trump people, they want to be on a path to balancing the budget in this term. I think that's insane. But I think that they will. That is what they are driving to. That's why it's weird. You have to listen to technology podcasters out of California to get into the mind of Elon Musk. You can't listen to Washington lobbyists to get into the mind of Elon Musk. So listen, I could be wrong. But that's the scenario that I think is emerging and I think is being reflected in the financial markets. What else explains 10-year interest rates coming down this much? I think maybe a little bit of a slowdown, but I think it's slowdown plus government policy.
Are there any other big technological or geopolitical themes that you currently spend a lot of time thinking about?
Well, of course. So to extend crypto, the high level themes, I think, are in 2023, there was a big evolution in blockchain databases. So the two databases were the Bitcoin Store of Value and Ethereum smart contracts. But the problem with both was that the transaction fees or the costs of putting transactions through those databases was very variable. Now, what drove them was kind of stupid, like cat videos or meme coins or NFTs. But regardless, no corporate, IT person is going to build something on a blockchain when the costs are unpredictable, right? I mean, that's insane. They would never even do that. But that problem was fixed in 2023, right? Because you went to high throughput, low cost, reliably low cost blockchains like Solana or what they call layer twos that use the Ethereum protocol, but they do it at lower fees. And so that's a big change in 2023 that I'll call it like a corporate IT person could take blockchain development seriously. That's number one. And then the number two thing, it's being discussed in policy daily, is stable coins. Will stable coins, well, it's my thesis, our thesis, that stable coins are going to become part of the global payment system. So it's not going to go from SWIFT to stable coins in a day, but we do see usage accelerating in stable coins, and with a positive regulatory outlook, stable coins could be much bigger part of sort of payments globally and remittances. I mean, before I think we started, I was joking. But like seriously, you know, one of our former presidents passed away, sad about that, but our banking system was shut down. I mean, if you're trying to run a business in Argentina or Mexico or Hong Kong, like why should that mean that you can't move your money? I think it's inevitable that moves. Whether we at VanEck are investing in the right software companies to profit from that stablecoin thing, I think we are, because we don't believe most companies will develop that software themselves. They're going to want to, you know, buy or rent that software. But that's kind of that's the technology, I would say, stablecoin evolution in relating to blockchain, which is deflationary for financial services companies, right? Internationally, I wouldn't say that there's a ton of investable things. A lot of them are shorter term and very politically driven, whether it's Middle East or Ukraine ceasefire. I like to focus on what I was talking about before, the longer, more secular trends.
We're having this conversation, I think, 2 days now after the U.S. crypto reserve was announced. Do you have any thoughts there? I'll leave it open to you. Any thoughts on the U.S. establishing that?
I think the SEC is being really responsible in clarifying to the market what's permissible and what they're not going to worry about. And there are a lot of, you know, this is sort of crypto insider talk, right? But SAB 121, which prevented banks from getting involved, that was changed. Meme coins were said no, like as long as you're not doing anything, we're not going to pay attention to that kind of casino. And I think they have a very thoughtful questionnaire that I think the deadline is tomorrow that we're going to put in a response to. I would say that some of the actions that are, or tweets that are coming out of the White House and related parties are not fully thought through or not particularly healthy for the ecosystem. So you mentioned over this past weekend, there were some announcements. It temporarily drove the price up, and then 48 hours later, prices were right back to where they were. So I think that we are moving into this new regime where tweets out of DC or elsewhere are not going to change the pricing. I mean, we're in a deep bear market for most crypto assets, right? Happy to talk about that, but the good and the bad.
Yeah. As we kind of wrap things up here, I guess one question for VanEck specifically, what do you think makes VanEck's approach to building portfolios different than other ETF managers?
Again, our approach is this sort of longer term macro and then giving you, here's a Bitcoin ETF. Here's our story. You decide for yourself whether you want to add it to your portfolio, right? So it accentuates that back and forth with the client in terms of giving you the pros and cons, hopefully, of every investment, but then having you decide for yourself. And, hopefully over time, that's been a fruitful conversation. I think just to differentiate, right, we don't offer the very cheap access ETFs. So cheap S&P or NASDAQ, that's just not something that we do. We like to kind of add value if we can to our ETFs. And I talked before about trying to avoid the fads and the kind of naming that leads to disappointment. But, you know, we only do our best. And there are a lot of great ETF companies out there. So, you know, I'm proud of what we offer, but we're in good company.
All right. Last question. You've been in the industry for some time. What advice would you give to someone entering the investment industry today?
Yeah, I mean, for any industry, I think what are the big macro trends, right, that are going to drive employment? I think you don't want to be disrupted by technology. I kind of say real estate, unlikely to be disrupted by technology. As long as it rains and gets cold, people will want houses to live in, right? The structure of that market may change. Within finance, since the global financial crisis, so much, and I would argue overregulation, so much of the market now is private, right? So private equity, venture capital, private credit. So will that change? Probably not, right? So are markets inefficiencies being rewarded through compensation? Yes. So if you're looking for a career, you know, look for those types of things. I mean, sorry, I have to say, obviously, you have to enjoy what you do, right? So find that fit for your personality. Is it talking to people, or is it crunching numbers, or is it being an engineer and solving engineering problems? Like, you just have to figure out what makes you happy to get up in the day. But those are kind of the things I think about.
All right, that's going to do it for today. Thank you all for tuning in to this episode of AUM. I'd like to remind listeners that the AUM podcast is for informational and educational purposes only. All opinions expressed on the show by hosts or guests are solely their own and do not constitute formal advice or recommendation. Thank you to Jan for joining the show, and thank you all again for listening. We'll see you next time.